do the work that we do. Van Guizzi, Autumn Chanel Vilji, Chief Jim Cooey, Janet Cooey, Jacqueline Cooey, Vivian Cooey, Shadeji. My name is Autumn Chanel. I am a member of Gwich'in First Nation. I was born and raised in Amaskwachi, Wisconsin, traditional lands of the Cree, Métis, Nakota Sioux, and Soto peoples. I'm really lucky and grateful to be studying here on Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh lands.
My names are Rachel Lau and Lau Hole. I'm a Han Chinese settler who was born and raised on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. I'm incredibly privileged and grateful as a settler to be able to live and work on these lands. As coordinators of this doc series, we had the pleasure of working with Indigenous and non-Indigenous students here at the University of British Columbia.
This project is funded by the Equity Enhancement Fund and created in collaboration with the UBC First Nations and Indigenous Studies Program and the Institute for Critical Indigenous Studies.
We produce these docs with the intention of centering Indigenous perspectives on feminism, poetry, student life, and health and wellness.
You might be listening to these docs on Stitcher, iTunes, CITR.ca, or live on CITR 101.9 FM. Docs from the Carving Space series will be released every Monday until May 14th.
For more info on the docs and the series, visit CITR.ca.
And evolution is living up to the names I'm given. Revolution is giving love to the change I'm living.
That's Mitchell Lestouchi, and this is him performing his poem You at Vancouver Poetry Slam about a year ago.
And introvertedness means if I speak up, I mean it. So if you call me angry, you haven't fucking seen it. Because churches never provide a purpose that told me I'd earn my feathers. But sure as hell told me that I'd burn forever. And before 51, it was a crime to sing. Sometimes there are no words to define the thing, so I went ahead and named myself a mind with wings. And what's more dangerous than a dragon thick that burn your waving flag and wagging finger? As much as it is cathartic to share my anger with you, I stop harboring all my pain and my anchors lift up. And my cheeks turn hot air balloons to my inner fire, stronger than the 150 red and white ones that eclipse it. And my smile is just a cracked and crescent moon to my inner fire. And my smile is a signal to colonialism that they did not extinguish this and they did not seek English on this, because this smile speaks to every language you've ever tried to silence. I smile and mean it. I speak and breathe it. And despite being declared ghastly, in order for me to believe it, it's you. Need to understand that this fire and smile comes in the same places, unseated. And for every night, I mourn the constellations of my ancestors 525 light years forward. I'm on my own spiritual journey across the back of Turtle Island. And spaces within myself and every new step on this spacewalk away from your fewer thought territory comes with fewer and fewer tethers. And on the cold, dark days, the only thing I have to hold on to is cedar shavings on the drive, and this body feels nothing more than carved by poverty. I want to hold this and hold what's left of me to my own eternal flame forevermore. I warm my hands on the breath and word of poets instead.
You're listening to Rhyme and Resilience, one of the four docs in the Carving Space doc series. For this doc, I had the pleasure of chatting with New Channels poet Mitchell Lestouchi and Cree Métis poet Samantha Nock. In my conversations with Sam and Mitchell, they tell me what it's like to be an Indigenous poet living and working in what's colonially known as Vancouver. This is part one of Rhyme and Resilience, featuring Mitchellus. Tune in next week for part two, where I'll be chatting with Sam Nock about poetry, bodies, and belonging. Before we dive in, though, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Rachel Lau. I'm a Han Chinese settler who was born and raised on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. And this documentary is being recorded and broadcasted on the unceded territories of the Musqueam people. So, remember the poet you heard earlier, Mitchellus? Let's get to know him a little bit better.
My name is Mitchellus. I'm a spoken word artist and a poet. I'm a host of the Mixless Mixtape podcast. Both have podcast episodes available online, and we do live shows as well, hosting a number of poets. So I'm a Canadian Festival of Spoken Word 2017. It was a Rising Voice Poet of Honor.
In the next part of our conversation, Mitchellus shares some of his childhood experiences relating to foster care that may be difficult for some listeners. So first question that I have for you is, how did poetry find you?
I think poetry found me a number of times. I think the first time that I found it, or it found me, it was I was transcribing all my favorite lyrics back when I was like 13 years old. And they were bad lyrics, but it meant a lot to me at the time. And from transcribing, ended up going to adding my own lines, and then finally just creating whole new pieces. And all throughout my teens and adolescence and all that madness is the only and tool, I suppose, for me to sort out my thoughts and feelings and everything I was going through. And then it found me again in the form of a poetry slam when I moved out here to Vancouver. And from there, spoken word scene, much larger than just a poetry slam.
Tell me more about these feelings that you were trying to process through poetry when you were younger.
Yeah, so going through a lot of like what I thought were, back then I labeled them like abandonment issues. It was obviously growing up, you learn things are much more complex than that. I was a foster child. I was went through a lot of different homes and stuff, and felt like I was let down by a lot of adults and abandoned and never really feeling connection to any real parental figures or anything. So then it also became about sorting through all the little non-relationships that I had, because I've never stayed in one place. It was basically going through puberty, and I remember instead of going to dances and following through with the crushes that I had, I would sit at home and write poetry instead. I remember that. There's one specific memory. There was a dance, and I really wanted to go, but I was like, instead of asking the person out, I ended up writing a poem, and I was like, well, what do I do with this? I never got that far. All I did was kept writing poetry. And then, yeah. So nothing came of it besides an awful, awful teenager poem. A lot of teen angst.
I mean, teen angst feels a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not always a bad thing.
And without it, who knows? Who knows where my life would have been, really?
So speaking of teen angst, do you ever draw upon those times when you were skipping dances and writing poetry instead in the poetry that you make now?
No, so it's all, you know, picking up and leaving everything behind 3 years ago is really leaving a lot of those thoughts behind, and just now stumbled back into that thought just now, so maybe it's a sign. Maybe I do want to think about it, and maybe it could be something I focus on soon.
I mean, it sounds like it would be a challenging time of your life to revisit, so it's understandable that that's not something that you're pursuing at the moment. Yeah. So tell me more about the second time that poetry found you in the form of spoken word and poetry slam here in Vancouver.
Yeah, so when I moved to Vancouver, I was searching for a group or a community or at least one person. And so I spent the first few months, I didn't know anybody, I didn't know a single person. I ended up landing at a friendship center, and there weren't many very programs there. So I remember being really disappointed and sitting outside the friendship center, and I'm looking across the street and I see this big intimidating building. It's like and it's got graffiti on it. It says UNYA, Urban Native Youth Association. I'm like, what is that? And it looks like it's all locked up and there's nobody there. But then I was like, I'm going to go there. I really need to find something. And I went there and I found the Overly Creative Minds studio, and they have free drop-in for Indigenous and Aboriginal youth under 25. And so what they have there, basically an open studio with everything you could need to be creative. There's recordings, there's video, there's paint, there's carving. Not so much carving, but sometimes they bring people in. There's different, people do basically different residencies to teach these things, like carving, like cedar weaving and drum making. And so it blew me away and changed me forever. And at the time, they were preparing for, they had a partnership with the Talking Stick Festival. And they had an event shared between them. It was like Urban Native Youth Association over the Creative Minds has their own show within the Talking Stick Festival. And that's the moment that I dropped in and joined that show. And so they brought us to Vancouver Poetry Slam to show us how people do a slam. And it happens every Monday. And that, from that point on, I fell in love with Poetry Slam and with the event itself. And never even knew before that that people performed poetry and read it out loud to other people. It was just a tool for me until that point. It was like the first year within poetry, it was a massive changing thing for me. Vancouver Poetry Slam. Love that place.
Do you remember the first poem that you performed at Slam?
Yeah, it was the first time I stepped on the open mic. I was kind of just jotted down thoughts, and I remember it was a really tiny piece of paper. That's all I had at the time, and I was like, I jotted it down, and it was about my father, and I was like, I never met him, and back then I was still sorting through all my feelings about him. I didn't quite know the things he'd gone through, so by then I was just like, you know, F him that way and F him this way in various ways that I thought, and it was an unfinished piece, but I'm glad I brought it up. And then the next piece I did, I was to compete in the Poetry Slam. I went up and I basically just headbanged for a while. So it's something that Vancouver Poetry Slam has like inspired me. You know, it's like so many different approaches to what you can do within the 3 minutes. And like this, I just wanted to mention that. It's like, you know, that's how it inspired me. You know, I could go up, I could sort through my feelings about my dad and my creators, and then the next moment I could be up there headbanging and just like rocking out to nothing. Yeah, those were the first pieces that I did on the stage there.
So from what you're telling me, it sounds like poetry moved from this more personal practice that you had to something that became more public that you shared with other people. So what was that like for you to share your poetry with others?
Yeah, it was wild. It was everything I dreamed of, really. I always wanted to be like a performer. Before then, I didn't quite understand a whole lot about, you know, performing arts and all it takes to be a performing artist, especially. And I didn't have the context of, you know, living in the whatever third most expensive city in the world. I just dove right in, and I was excited every single moment of the way. And I've always had an appreciation for live performers, but there's something to be said about how back when I lived, you know, away from performance art, I didn't quite have an ear for live music or live performance. It's all studio stuff that I listened to and grew to appreciate. It's not that it shouldn't be appreciated, it's just sometimes you lack the like the real respect for performing artists. God, it takes so much. This is one of the many ways I've grown from being a performer. When I remember the first few like years of performing, I was always like, I have to remember and to remind myself that, you know, this always was for me and for me alone. And I've since been giving more and more audiences, that has affected me in the way I write and the way I want to speak. I've learned a lot about intersections and feminism as well, and also just Yeah, just the context of living in Vancouver, living in a really expensive city, living from being on reserve to in an urban area, been treated very differently in all these different places and then responded very differently.
Right. So how has your experiences here so far affected the kind of poetry that you write?
I remember somebody saying to me, after listening to a lot of my performed poetry, they were like, there's a certain violence underneath your voice, underneath what you're saying. And hearing that was important, and it hurt. You know, I had to process a lot of things, and I'd have to say that it's not just my performance and participation in performances, but everything I'm learning outside of it as well. It's coming from, you know, a society that leans and exploits on so many different people, and the way I'm situated within the systems and my different privileges and all sorts of different things. It takes a lot to process and to digest and to honestly speak on it on stage, and I'm doing my best to honor that time and that gestation period of all the lessons I've been given. I think that's the biggest and hardest way learning has affected my poetry and my writing. But it's important. And when I perform and when I write and when I speak to an audience out loud, I always want to set an example of what I'm going through. And I want to set the example in a good way.
What do you mean by setting an example in a good way?
You have to take care of the audience you speak to. And that's going to look different with whatever you're trying to say. What are you bringing up? What abstractions are you making? And what are you leaving the audience with? What abstractions are you going to leave them with? If they only have so much, will they, you know, fail to take it to your desired outcome, where you want them to learn and to think about things? Whereas sometimes, you know, performers and poets, especially, I can't speak towards especially, but, you know, we've seen it happen on Poetry Slam stages quite a lot, where we dig our trauma up and then just leave nothing for everybody to do with it. They're just like, what do we do with this? And it's just, you got up there and it was hopefully cathartic and hopefully medicinal for you, but you got to leave with hope or action or at least a bit of further understanding.
So it sounds like when you're writing poetry, like you mentioned, you keep your audience and listener in mind. So when you are writing poetry now, who do you write your poetry for? I know you said an audience, but who in the audience?
Yeah, that's been the toughest question over the past few months. Before it used to kind of come naturally, and then it might either be because I held on to certain perceptions that made it easier for me to say these things. Yeah, things just kind of came naturally before. I'd say now it's learning to be motivated and prompted by the people around me. I want to reflect not only, you know, myself, but the people around me and what they've taught me, because that's who I am. I'm made up of all the people I'm around. Yeah, I think what I'm on the search for now is the person who I'm talking to. I have a few things in mind, a few people in mind, and with the next project that I'm working on, with the next pieces that I'm writing, and it's challenging, and I suppose I'm just now coming to say this out loud right now, and where it's like, yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Who am I talking to? Now that it's not coming naturally.
Yeah, it sounds like it's very much a process for you. So we spoke a lot about intersections that you embody and how that affects your poetry. So how does your identity, whatever parts of that you want to speak to, intersect with your poetry?
As a as a man on the res, like, we're built up to be, to feel entitled to say a lot of things, and we're given a lot of space to do so, whereas other voices in our communities are not. I've been thinking about that a lot, and, you know, being wary of the space that I'm taking, be wary of the places that I'm invited to, because I am I'm a guest everywhere I go. You know, if I'm not in Yitluwathot, which is where I'm from, and been learning how to treat everything as such, you know. So if to be an honored poet, a rising voice, I gotta remember how to listen and how to speak only for myself, if that's what my intention is. It's taught me a lot there. That's the lens I'm going through. There's so many new lenses to examine my life in, and there's new lenses to examine through poetry. It's a lot. It's, on paper, my identity is ridiculously complicated. Like, I was born an Indian and never had culture, and then lived on reserve, and then I was taken out and foster parents and everything in foster homes. And then in 2011, my nation, among four others, there's five nations, signed a treaty, developed our own constitution. Now we have this weird special relationship with Canada, and we will no longer be Indian after this. And so on paper, there's just, and then also examining how, like, you know, these are unceded territories, and if I'm no longer an Indian, what does that mean? What spaces am I taking now? I'm going through a lot right now, and I'm 10,012 days old right now. I'm taking a lot of motivation from that as well. You know, I never thought I'd be this old, and I wasn't going to let myself be this old. And I've taken a tremendous amount of motivation from that, and whatever it comes from, all the things I'm processing, it has to be unique and valuable as well. And I want, if I'm to be a rising voice, remember how to listen. Remember how to speak for yourself. And remember to make way or make room for voices who aren't getting that. So much going on in my life. Crap.
So what is it like to hold all of those things, especially when you're trying to put it on paper as poetry?
Yeah, it's hard. It's challenging. It's been like a big thing since getting both the honor of the Rising Voice and both, you know, just learning these things and reaching this age. I think I've been dealing with a bit of self-doubt and writer's block to a certain extent. I'm still writing and I'm still writing, but I don't have the full thoughts, and I haven't found the answer to making full, you know, half thoughts interesting enough to be a poem. I find, obviously, some of my goals are to make abstractions and to make compelling poetry. It's some seriously emotional and heavy things a lot of the time. And while dealing with living in the most expensive city in the world. it's a challenge, but I'm here for it. And within the spoken word community, there's a tremendous amount of support and trust and faith that I'm trying to reflect and try to embody. It's taught me so much.
So what keeps you going?
I gotta find a new thing, like, every minute. It's some things I hold on to, like I mentioned, reaching 10,000, counting the days and making them count, and I hold on to the relationships that I've made and the relationships that I've messed up in the past few years. I hold on to all of it, and it's important to keep the honor. You know, this honor could go every way and could go awry in the respect and the caring of each other. Yeah, I hold on to the belief also that, you know, when I reach 10,000 days, I've got closer to examining, you know, I do deserve life and I do deserve love. And that's something that I want to share and to learn my way around. Been holding on to that a lot. I haven't felt valuable. I haven't felt worthy. I felt guilt and shame and all these things are kind of normal, but the feelings are valid, but the logic behind it isn't. And that's what I'm coming to find more and more often about my guilt and my shame and my decisions that and mistakes and everything. You know, trying to hold on to it as much as I can while taking care of myself. There's a couple of powerful philosophies that help me along that way. Hishuk ishtawak means everything is one and everything is interconnected. To me, it's like, it's, I add all sorts of things to it. There's like the butterfly effect, there's intersectionality, there's infinity, there's the whole universe, and that's what Hishuk ishtawak means to me. It means all these things. It's another lens that I hold on to. And another one is Tsawaksquina. It means we are all from one root. We are all from connected again. And it brings it closer to, you know, the foundations of who you are. You know, you got to take care of the roots. Take care of what grows from you and what falls off and how you're contributing to the people around you in short and long run. So there's Hishakish Tsawak, Tsawaksquina, and Isak, which means... It kind of means respect, and it kind of means with caring. So it's respect with caring. I feel like sometimes respect without the caring is just held over somebody, and it's like, it creates a hierarchy. With respect with caring, it means you make a connection rather than trying to be either unified or powered over that. I have little tiny little pieces of traditional Nuchanal language and philosophy. I only get a few short bursts here and there in my life, and it only began, that journey only began for me by the time I was like 20. So, you know, I keep asking myself, how many times am I going to have growing pains, and how many times am I going to grow up from this? It's a lot. So I hold on to a lot of the indigenous and Nuchanal's philosophies here and there that I get.
Yeah, it sounds like it holds a really important place in your heart and in your life, and it really forms most of what you do.
Yeah.
We're coming to a close now, and the last question that I have for you, Michalos, is what's next for you?
What's next is... this is the first time I'm saying it, and like, I can't leave this room until it's released. I'm opening up for Buffy St. Marie in April, April 22nd at the Wise Hall, part of Versus Festival. And then also the Mixerless Mixtape podcast has been invited to be sort of an official podcast in partnership with the actual festival itself, the Versus Festival. We're looking to do lots of interviews and lots of different bits throughout the whole week of the Versus Festival, and I so look forward to it. I'll be putting out more episodes as well. So Mixtape at Versus Festival, and then Michalis is doing some poetry at the Wise Hall.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, Michalis.
Tleko.
After my conversation with Michalis, I learned that poetry can be a space for healing, reflection, and inspiration. The way that one carries themselves through their words is not only important, but life-changing. This has been Rhyme and Resilience. Tune in next week for part two, where I'll be chatting with Sam Nock about her experiences as a Cree Métis poet. Here's a little preview of next week's talk.
I didn't think I was ever going to write about my body. It's a really weird thing to write about, and being a fat woman, it's also just like really hard because it's terrifying. But I started writing about my body in ways that I could kind of write myself into existence, like write about my body in ways that made me love myself more. And so I found comfort in doing that by comparing my body to the places I grew up and the land I grew up with.
I'm Rachel Lau, and thank you for listening. Bye. A documentary from Carving Space, an Indigenous radio doc series.
If you like what you heard, feel free to visit CITR.ca for more info.
Or tune in every Monday at 11 a.m. until May 14th for docs in this series. I'm Rachel Lau.
And I'm Autumn Schnell. Thank you for listening.
That's it.
Masi cho.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM's special programming for National Indigenous